This is Justin Meeklem of Stockhouse Media sitting with investing icon Rick Rule of Sprott Investments at the Sprott National Resource Symposium. Thank you for joining us this morning, Rick.
Pleasure to be with you, Justin. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. So we're here at the Summer Symposium. What are you hearing from both investors and your resource exhibitors this week?
Let's start by saying this is a fairly selective crowd and probably not reflective of junior resource markets worldwide. The attendees that you see at this conference have, many of them, been coming here for 15 years. This is a battle-scarred, wealthy group, and I wouldn't say that they are representative of the lame, the halt, and the blind that normally attend resource conferences. Similarly, at the Sprott conference, exhibitors are selected from companies that we own in performance fee-generating accounts where we as principals have invested money. At most conferences, including some good ones, the qualification to be an exhibitor is a check that cashes and a pulse in just that order. At Sprott, our attendees have told us that the exhibitors are content, not advertisers. So what you see here is a fairly high-quality group of attendees and a fairly high-quality group of exhibitors. I would suggest that the outlook in this conference has been uniformly bullish, something that isn't necessarily representative of the natural resource market. That's a function of high-quality speakers, not second-tier speakers, high-quality companies, not second-tier companies, and high-quality investors, not second-tier investors. So while I would suggest to you that the exhibitors that we have here are cashed up and doing good work, that isn't representative of the broad market. The investors here are cashed up and looking for opportunities, but that's not representative of the market either. So, to answer your question directly, the mood at the conference is extremely bullish, but nobody should confuse that with the junior resource market at large.
Yeah. You speak about high quality. Part of the show, you hosted a star-studded Legends panel. For those investors who weren't there, what did they miss?
You know, it's important for investors to understand how the business really works. Too often, investors focus on the share price, which is easy to obtain but useless information. It's value that drives investment performance, and it's people that drive value. So the proposition that we have with the Living Legends panel are people who have built billion-dollar companies or multi-billion-dollar companies in resources from square one. And the lessons that they have learned in building the companies, and then specifically the lessons that investors can learn from people where the rubber meets the road. It's important at a conference like this to have the big picture gurus. It's also important for investors to be able to access people who have done it and teach them how the market really works. So what did we learn? One thing we learned is that 5% of the management teams in the junior sector deliver 100% of the value. The first thing that you have to do as an investor is you have to segregate against the lame, the halt, and the blind and send them back to selling cars or whatever productive thing they did before they came into the junior market. Warren Buffett says famously that around the world, millions of people, tens of millions of people can play basketball. But to win a game, you got to have some seven-footers. I had 4 seven-footers up there, 4 guys who won the game, built big, big, big companies from standing start.
And sorry, for the people who weren't there, who was on the panel?
Let me think back. Randy Smallwood, my friend Randy Smallwood, who built Silver Wheaton from nothing to $15 billion market cap. Robert Friedland, who has been successful more times than an old man like me can count. Ross Beatty, whom I've known so long that he was a TA when I was an undergrad at UBC, has built 14 successful companies over 40 years. And Sean Rosen, who has been remarkably successful. The biggest success, of course, was building Osisko from a little tiny, small, high-grade camp into a 10-million-ounce resource in northern Canada. Absolute seven-footer. So the first thing we learned is that early on, people are more important than properties. The second thing we learned, and what I was really beating the legends to get out, is that investors' time expectations are unrealistic. All of these guys worked a decade to be overnight successes. Mm-hmm. Investors have this nervousness, I think because they don't understand the stocks they own. They have trauma holding stock over a long weekend. In each case, these guys took between 5 and 7 years to build a company. So a retail buyer who buys something with a sort of a 3-month time frame is lying to his or herself. Mm-hmm. So disaggregated time frames, I think, is something that we learned about. In my own life, when I look back at the trades that have really worked for me, the 10-baggers, the 20-baggers, the 30-baggers, the average elapsed time for me is almost 5 years, because adding value in exploration is answering a series of unanswered questions. And to get a double or a triple involves one yes. To get a 10-bagger or a 15-bagger requires 3 or 4 sequential yeses. And the yeses take between 12 and 18 months. So to think about how you get a stock from $1 to $10, other than luck, what you've had to do is answer 3 or 4 successive questions, which takes 18 months each. In other words, mm-hmm. you've taken 5 years. I think the third thing is simple persistence and tenacity. Each of the 7-footers that I questioned told me that at least twice, and usually 3 times, in the course of building a company that yielded tenfold gains to investors, they experienced 50% share price declines. Hmm. At least twice during that period of time. So a stock goes from $1 to $4. It goes from $4 to $2. In the process of going from $4 to $2, it shakes most speculators out. Now the truth is, if you like something at $4, you better like it at $2, or you don't understand what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I think another thing is scale. Most people, I think, go into junior resource speculation as a lifestyle exercise. I think many geologists go in because they want to be in the north and fish all summer. And they get involved in a property because they can raise money to it. Their idea of a success is jitneying a 12-cent stock to 27 and making sure they get paid for the next 18 months. What you find out with the 7-footers is they're completely unconcerned about their lifestyle. They are concerned about building big companies. So they don't mess around with a 200,000 ounce or a 300,000 ounce deposit. They have zero interest in a small mine. They actually have zero interest in a salary. They have zero interest in a Maserati. They have interest in taking risk and being tenacious and finding, or in some other way acquiring, a 5-million-ounce deposit or a 7-million-ounce deposit. And the other thing they've done, which is really important, is each of the 4 of them understand that by themselves, they would have accomplished nothing. Their job is to assemble a community, or rather a coalition of communities. One community would be an investment community. People who will back them through thick and thin, who will kill for them in capital markets. Another community is the community of employees, because it's teams that find and build mines. Robert Friedland never built a mine, but he's been part of building many great mines. And what Robert will tell you is that the people who he assembled, the people who he backed, are how the mines got built. And the third community that you find in case of all 4 of those communities, all 4 of those promoters, are the local communities. This ESG thing that's all of a sudden fashionable, these guys were building ties to Aboriginal communities, Indigenous communities, local communities 20 years ago, way before it was fashionable, because they understood that if the locals didn't have an affirmative stake in what they were doing, they were going to be unsuccessful. A lot of people in the world pay lip service to ESG, and they do ESG to fill out blanks on a due diligence form. Mm-hmm. The 7-footers do ESG not because it's politically correct, or that it makes the World Bank feel better about what they're doing. They do it because they understand that social license to operate is an important thing of what they're doing. And in the case of all four of them, they do it because they lack people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the right thing to do. So I'd say in that panel, that's what we learned.
Yeah, it was an absolute highlight of our week. But when you talk about investor expectations on time frame, at the same time, you know, up here, cannabis legalization is coming to Canada in the fall. How closely have you been following that sector?
Well, I mean, closely. How closely have I been following it? I'm 65 years old, and so I haven't done any detailed due diligence on cannabis for about 40 years. I look forward to correcting that now that it's legal and my risks are lower. I think it's in every sense a good thing. Philosophically, I think what I do to my body is my business, not the government's. And I'm delighted with the fact that they're going to cut crime in half by making less things illegal. So first of all, I see that as a social good. The idea that you should catch some kid smoking a joint at 17, throw him in prison, and turn him into a real criminal, I think is insane. So at the very, very, very top of the discussion, other than the fact that it increases government revenue, which I think is horrible, I think it's solely a good thing. I'm amused to see the proliferation of marijuana companies in Vancouver. I think that's good for two reasons. It clears the ranks of failed mining companies, which the industry needs in the worst way. I mean, these promoters are cockroaches. You can't kill them. And the fact that rather than kill them, that we've diverted them to something else is good. Beyond that, it's useful to have it in Vancouver. We have a bunch of management teams now that are finally involved in a business that they understand and that they've been involved with for a very long time. Many of them knew nothing about mining and lots about marijuana, so it makes perfect sense that they would migrate to marijuana. And I'm only partially joking. You know, you're from Vancouver, so you know that due diligence is done on almost every street corner, every night. I mean, this is a town with deep, deep expertise in marijuana. So it makes sense that it would be here. Looking further out, this doesn't have a happy ending. When you raise this much money this quickly in an industry, people forget in the excitement of the uptick that the backside of a hockey stick graph is just as steep as the front side and a hell of a lot less fun. Now, when we look further out, and my Canadian friends are going to hate me for saying this, you have a market, Canada, which has 6.5% of the disposable income in North America. As marijuana eventually becomes legalized in the United States, and despite dinosaurs like Sessions, that will happen. One state will dominate the North American marijuana market. That's California. Well, on a per capita basis, we don't know as much about marijuana as Canada does. There are more of us. And we are wealthier, and we can grow anything in California that there is a cash margin on better than almost any other place in the world. Now, that's not going to matter for 2 years or 3 years. In the early stages of a bull market, stocks move on narrative. In the later stages of a bull market, or the later stages of an industry, reality takes over. And the reality is that the Canadians will never be able to compete with California in a consumer goods market, particularly one that that requires growing technology. First mover advantage, absolutely. Another stock that goes from a 20 million market cap to a 200 million market cap, absolutely. Economic stability, absolutely not. We at Sprott, as you know, are specialty lenders to the mining business. We looked at becoming specialty lenders to the cannabis business. You know, a natural extension of our franchise. And without naming names, about a month ago, we looked at a marijuana company with a $1 billion market cap, and we couldn't find collateral for a $25 million loan.
Wow.
I think that speaks volumes.
Wow. So sticking to resource, looking at the current market conditions there, and investors, what are you expecting for the last 6 months of 2018?
You know, for us, for me at least, the first 6 months of 2018 have been pretty good. I hear juniors telling me they can't raise money. And then I look at Cobalt 27. They raised $880 million in 12 months. Pretty good raise from a standing start, you know? I know how hard I'm having to compete right now. to do financings in companies I like. I think the industry prefers dumb money. So the generalist investors are busy trying to lose money in blockchain and pot. They're tired of losing money in mining for a while. That'll change. But what you're finding in this market is a wonderful coalition between high-quality companies and high-quality investors. It's useful to note that over the last 12 months on the TSX, and also, interestingly, on the ASX, among the companies that we follow, 60% of the equity contributions to the companies have been by major mining companies. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing is the return of the smart money and the exit of the dumb money, which is always a good thing. I'm, in the next 6 months, going to do three things with my own money. The first is that we've assembled a list of 23 companies which we think are reasonable takeover targets in the next 18 to 24 months, because we see a continuation of the M&A cycle, which is just getting started now. You'll know that there was a real hiatus in M&A as a consequence of the idiotic M&A that took place in the last decade. Big mining companies and middle-term mining companies have rebuilt their balance sheets and rebuilt their income statements. So they're lean and mean, they're cashed up, but they haven't invested for 8 years, which means that their development pipelines are empty, and they have to address that. They have the means, they have the need. When the means exist and the need exists and the targets exist, transactions occur, and that's going to happen. I want to take this list down because I don't want to invest in 23 companies. I don't want to follow 23 companies. I want to take the list down to five or six and buy meaningful positions in five or six companies where I like the value proposition and I have a good sense who ought to own it. So that's the first thing I'm going to do, and I would encourage your readers to think about doing the same thing. The second thing that I'm going to do, and this is maybe more controversial but lower risk, is I'm going to double up on my positions in the royalty and streaming space, really across the waterfront. It is true that these companies on a price NAV basis are more expensive than the operating companies, but that's because their margins are on average four times the margins enjoyed by the rest of the industry. A better business deserves to be priced higher. But what people don't understand, people believe the growth phase with regard to the big royalty and streaming companies are over, and that's wrong. There's a mine finance wave that's coming at us over the next 6 or 7 years, and increasingly, funding part of the equity of building a mine off balance sheet through the sale of a royalty or stream is becoming an important part of development finance in the mining company. So we see the ability of these companies to add between $2 and $5 billion a year in assets for the next 5 years. In other words, we see the growth phase through all the companies in the industry, from companies as large as Franco-Nevada, all the way down through the Sandstorms and the Anglo-Pacifics and the EMX royalties, as exhibiting much more growth than people that we compete with see it. And we see it because as Sprott, as lenders, we compete with these guys every single day. And they're very, very, very formidable competitors. Mm-hmm. Well, I wish they weren't such formidable competitors. The truth is, when you see a formidable competitor who you can buy, you buy them. So I'm going to do that. The third thing I'm going to do is begin to forward shift risk. Risk is a very bad word in today's market. And so investors are running from risk as fast as they can. You buy low when you have no competition, and I have no competition in risk. So I'm going to be much more aggressive in the exploration space than my competitors. I had the good fortune last March to sit down with the CEO of a Vancouver-based multinational mining company. You can read between the lines, but I can't name the name. And he sat down next to me at a party, he smiled, and he said, "Rick, you have me right where you want me. We haven't explored for 8 years. Our crew of good earth scientists is greatly diminished because we couldn't pay them and they didn't have anything to do. Our exploration pipeline is empty, our development pipeline is empty, and frankly, we're understaffed. We have to do deals with juniors. We have to do deals with juniors." Now, I love to hear that. In addition to the fact that he has to, he has billions of dollars available to do it. And his board of directors has said, "You must." Okay?
Wow.
So the stage is set. A junior makes a discovery, a good discovery. The majors aren't necessarily even going to wait through feasibility study. They're going to say, you know what, we've got 15 holes in this. We have a good idea how it ends. This stock is a lot cheaper at $2 than it was at 50 cents because the data's better. We're going to buy it all. But more commonly, for me, you're going to see companies get involved in exploration joint ventures with my favorite category of explorers, which are the prospect generators. The prospect generators get no attention because they don't dilute. The investment banks hate them because there's no fees, so nobody publishes research. The fact that they don't dilute is useful to me. The fact that they use other people's money to advance their projects means something very good to me. It means that the big investment banks don't do the due diligence on them. Other mining companies do, their peers. The big investment banks do due diligence with the vision of earning a fee selling me stock. The major mining companies do due diligence with a view of investing $5 million or $10 million or $15 million. Much more honest process. So in every circumstance, I'm attracted to this. These companies are dirt cheap. They've been through 8 years of hell. They're really, really, really smart, really, really, really tough companies. Mm-hmm. Their customers need their product and can afford to pay. And finally, when the due diligence is being done, yes, Sprott does due diligence. But if our due diligence is backed up by Goldcorp and Freeport-McMoRan and TechCorp mm-hmm. and Agnico Eagle, when that due diligence supplements our own due diligence, and importantly, when the people who do the due diligence are doing it with a view of writing $10 million checks, that gives me a great, warm, fuzzy feeling.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned EMX and Sandstorm. They're here today, so we'll go talk to them next. Great insight, Rick.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, and another great event.
If I sound enthusiastic, it's, you know, I'm 65 years old now. I've been in this business since 1974. This is, depending on how you count, my fourth or fifth major cycle. And at 65, I'm likely approaching my sell-by date. This is likely my last cycle with as much energy as I have.
No.
Now. In each of the past cycles, coming out of the bottom to the top, other people have made more than me, but I've made unconscionable amounts of money when everybody else is afraid. I remember Ned Goodman. This is really going to be good for your readers. Ned Goodman, I remember, in one of the down cycles, I was castigating myself. You know, I sold sort of 30% of my positions in the up market, but I had the 70%, and the 70% had sort of lost half in value. And I was saying, Ned, I don't know why I do this to myself. You know when there's nothing to buy, you ought to be selling. But I couldn't bring myself to do as much selling as I should have. What do you think's wrong with me? And he said, well, you're going to make the same mistake next time, too. I said, thanks. He said, and it's healthy. You should. He said, what happens at the top of a market is that you think you're a better analyst than your competitors, because it's true. And you think that you selected better management teams than your competitors, and that's true, too. And you paid attention to the assets and the balance sheet, and that's true. But when a market goes over the edge, none of that matters. You know, everything falls. But when a market comes back, your stuff does better. So here's, and this is Ned talking, not me, I'm just relating it to you. Here's the way it works. You come in at a market top because everybody does. That's how you start. The narrative is attractive when it's been proved in the immediate past. You start with, let's say, $100,000. And you turn that $100,000 into $50,000. That's the way it works. You learn some lessons, and if you're good, you kick out the losers at the bottom and you buy the things that you think are going to win the next bull market. You turn that 50 over 5 or 6 years into 500. You turn that 500 into 250. You turn that 250 into 2.5 million. You turn that 2.5 million into 1.5 million. And you turn that 1.5 million into 10 or 15. If you look over 30 years, what you did is you turned $100,000 into $15 million. Pretty good print. It's just in the periods where the market isn't kind to you that you feel bad, but none of that matters. And interestingly, Warren Buffett pointed that out at the Berkshire Hathaway annual general meeting not too long ago. He said 4 times during the period where Buffett and Munger had run Berkshire Hathaway, the stock had fallen by 50% or more in an 18-month period of time. Unpleasant to look at or live through, But when you look at a 50-year chart of Berkshire Hathaway, those 50% declines didn't show up on the long-term chart. So the message is that if this is what you do, if you really truly invest your time and treasure in the sector, you have to have yourself the financial and psychological stability to stay the bad trades. You have to have enough courage and conviction to go hard into the market when nobody else is. And you have to have the sense to sell at least some of your holdings when the market has made you look smart.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. I don't need to wish you luck in the next bull cycle, but thank you so much.
This is going to be easy.
Yeah, excellent. Rick, this has been Rick Rohl from Sprott Investments. We're here at the Vancouver Sprott Investment Resource Investment Symposium. That's Justin Nicklin with Stockhouse Media. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.